Thank you, okay, great, thank you. Thank you, Billy. All right.
Take your truck and go home. A couple of days before this, just past Thanksgiving, I was asked by the director of Harbor Homes, Peter Kelleher, if I would come by and offer a brief blessing for the meal that Harbor Homes was serving persons in our Nashua area who otherwise would not get a good Thanksgiving dinner due either to homelessness or just a lack of financial means to have that kind of a dinner. Of course, I was very glad to do so. The meal was served over in one of the newer facilities that Harbor Homes has just recently obtained on High Street, just off of Main Street over here. And I got there a little bit early, so Peter gave me a tour of the place, and he showed me how they had relocated a number of their offices. It used to be at their Amherst Street facility. They moved them over to High Street and took me around and showed me how other parts of the building are being used to house some of the other programs and services that Harbor Homes offers to our community. The way this organization has grown and developed over the past 25 years or so is really quite amazing. I'm very pleased to serve a stretch of time on their board for as long as you're allowed to be on it, back in the mid-1990s. Harbor Homes' primary mission, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is to provide living quarters for persons whose mental capabilities are not so diminished that they need to be institutionalized, but who still need some level of care and some level of assistance in order to live with the appropriate measure of independence that they can, in fact, live with. And as this organization has grown and developed, they've offered other kinds of outreach and assistance to this community as well. You've been going down to the post office to mail your packages here this past week in Nashua, you know, waiting some of those interminable lines. You may have noticed their latest project is right next door to it there. It's Buckingham House, being erected, as I say, next to the Nashua post office. It looks like it's nearly finished. And when it's done, it will provide living quarters for homeless veterans once it gets into operation. Well, my Thanksgiving visit to this High Street facility, interestingly enough, came about a week or so after a conversation Lee Page and I had been having down in my office about how this very organization got started. And as Lee told her, it began with a conversation that she and my predecessor and our minister emeritus, late Reverend Don Rowley, had. So we're just having it down the hall from where we are right here, Don's office then, mine now. And she and Don were discussing the need to which I had just alluded, the need for supervised, quasi-independent living facilities for mentally challenged persons who did not need to be permanently housed in an institution. And it was at that point, it was just an idea. It was words kind of floating around in that ethereal realm of wouldn't it be good if. But in this case, the words didn't just stay in the air. They were shared with other people in the Nashua community, various caregivers and mental health providers. And these words generated some energy, and they generated some commitment among those who heard them and spoke them. And an organization was created to give the words reality. And funds were generated, and a director and staff were hired, and facilities purchased and prepared for use. 25 years later, as I say, this organization provides a very great and needed service in this community. So at one time, it was just an idea floating around in a room, several yards away from the room we're in here, words in the air, that became flesh. Well, I'm guessing there are other creation stories about Harbor Homes out there, in addition to the one that I just told. I'm going to guess there are probably other people, in addition to Lee and Don, who were having conversations similar to the one that they had at the time, who actually thought of it first as if they're as important as the fact that it happened. The important thing, as I say, is that an idea, a concept, a hope, a dream, a wouldn't it be good if, didn't just stay up in the realm of the spirit, as it were, but became concretized, became flesh and blood and bricks and mortar. And countless lives have been strengthened and helped because of that. Well, that's good, but it's a true story. And I can see where it might seem like a rather unlikely lead-in to my Christmas sermon for this year. You're just going to have to stay with me for a few more minutes of time. For this Harbor Home story that I have told is something of a variation, or maybe you could even look at it as a retelling of my favorite version of the Christmas story. It's found in the New Testament Gospels. And that gospel's account really has none of the things in it that we generally associate with the Christmas story. No Mary, no Joseph, no angels, no shepherds or sheep, no magi, no stable, no Bethlehem. Most of all, no baby Jesus. Arguably, it's not even a Christmas story. And yes, we'll do Mary and Joseph and the baby in the manger next Sunday night. It's just not where we're going today. Well, the gospel I'm referring to is the fourth one. Gospel of John. Who this particular author John is basically unknown, but it's as good a name as any. Kind of has a nice alliteration to it. You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. It wasn't written in this. It was one of those four particular takes on the life of Jesus. This one wasn't written until early on in the second century, several decades after the other three were written. And by now, this fledgling church, if they were even calling themselves that at that time, was beginning to spread beyond being just a small sect in Judaism, which is how it originated, and now it was beginning to make inroads out into the larger Greco-Roman world at the time. So by the time you get up into about the second century, the target audience for this church, to put it in marketing terms, was no longer just the Jews in and around Palestine, but it was the people living in the lands all along the northern rim of the Mediterranean Sea, clear over to Rome. For these people, the claim that Jesus was the fulfillment, as Luke put it, the house and lineage of the Jewish King David, meant absolutely nothing to them because they had never heard of any King David. So the writer of this gospel, John, decides he better speak the language of this other world out there if he's going to relate to them in any kind of a way. So he leaves out the usual story and just starts off his gospel with some rather mystical and esoteric language about something called the Word. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. And goes on like that for a few verses until he finally comes to the one that says, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us." A couple verses after that, Jesus is getting baptized and starting out of his ministry. He's kind of goes from there. Which made me think that if John's gospel had been the only one that ever made it into the Bible, we would have no Christmas. And while I'm just as glad it didn't go that way, at least we wouldn't have to put up a lot of nonsense about a war on Christmas that Fox News seems to be so convinced it's being mercilessly waged, but we're not going to go there. We're going to stay on point. And to get where the writer John is going, we need to throw in, or I need to throw in just a dash of the Greek and Roman worldview here. Just a dash. I promise you I can do this in about 30 seconds. In the Greek and Roman worldview, you had these two realms of reality, I guess you could call it. It was a two-tiered universe. And on the top tier, there were these, what they call these eternal Platonic ideals, eternal truths and verities, the realm of the spirit. And this is where also all their gods and goddesses hung out. Everything sort of up there in this top tier of the universe. Then you had the temporal realm down here where we're all living. This was the world of, you know, messy stuff, and flesh and blood and material things and earth and dirt and all of that business. Those were the two tiers. I got that in 30 seconds, I think. At least close to your That's kind of like speed dating, in other words, you know? Which is something I never got a chance to try, and it's probably just as well. Anyway, John, as in the writer of John's gospel, then he's wondering, okay, how do I present this newly emerging religion, which eventually came to be called Christianity, to people who think in these kinds of categories, who see the world through this kind of a lens? And his opening verses, which I just read, are what he came up with. What this author is saying is that these eternal ideals, these eternal truths, these eternal verities that the Greeks and the Romans believed in, and which he decides to call the Word, which he equates with God, he says, it became real. He became actualized. Became incarnated. In flesh and blood, honest to goodness, human being. That's what incarnation means. In the flesh. Same derivation as the word carnivore. The Word became flesh. Dwelt among us. And that kind of language made much more sense to those who were first hearing it than stories about mangers and shepherds and magi. Beautiful as that story myth is. And so while I value the traditional story myth of Christmas for its poetic beauty, Gospel of John is really where the rubber hits the road. When I look at Christmas through my own lens as a religious humanist. For what is contained in these words, if you look both at and then through the language, what's contained in these words as I have come to read them is an affirmation of human possibility. The theological standpoint from which John is writing is that the Word or God decided to risk incarnation, risk becoming flesh for the sake of humanity. In other words, that which is ideal and eternal became real and temporal in order to show us what being fully human was and is really all about. And this is not, I would point out, a theology that I take literally, but it is one that I can draw a human challenge from, nonetheless. And that challenge or question to me, which I've also raised for all of us, is to what extent are we, called to make our words become flesh? What does it mean, on a human level, to risk incarnation? What does it mean on a human level, where we all live, to bring about the wonder of incarnation? I find the answer as simple as it is difficult. It simply means having the courage to incarnate the values we hold most dear. Often the faith of all that would diminish or deny those values, which is also can be quite difficult at times. For whenever there is resistance to injustice, word becomes flesh. Whenever a human need is addressed, word becomes flesh. When a simple act of kindness that brings some small ray of hope and joy into a life where hope and joy are in short supply, word becomes flesh. Whenever one seeks to discern and then make an effort to overcome evil and wrongdoing, word becomes flesh. And when after discouragement, defeat, or some inexplicable loss, one finds the means to stand up and sing and choose life once again, word becomes flesh. For the Greeks and the Romans, to make one more pass at them, it was this ethereal realm of the spirit, of the gods, of the ideal, that they felt was the most real. While this earthly realm, because it was so transitory, they said that was less real, kind of unreal. Now what happened? The theology in John's gospel just flips that around. The ideal becomes most real when it gets put on the ground, when it becomes lived out, when it becomes incarnate. The values we hold most dear, whether expressed through our Unitarian Universalist purposes and principles or by whatever means we name them and conceive of them, they only become real when we put them on the ground, when we make of them the wonder of incarnation. The ideal, the dream, the hope that Don Rowley and Lee Page were tossing around down the hall from here 25 years ago didn't become real until, in the most very literal sense, it was put on the ground. Form the Harbor Homes facilities in our community, which incarnate the idea that gave them birth. That's what incarnation is really about. And I want to go one more round the incarnation thing then as a way of beginning to come to a close here. Share with you some words by a UU minister colleague of mine, Reverend Don King. He writes, "The real miracle of Christmas is that an uneducated peasant in an obscure corner of the Roman Empire should have the insight, the ability, and the character to formulate and proclaim the religion that Jesus did. Here was an individual who saw the significance of his cultural and religious heritage in his world and had the courage to attack the vested interests of his day in order to teach what he saw to be the truth. Here is the real miracle, the personality of this human being, not floating stars, angel choirs, or virgin births." And then Reverend King goes on with these words. "The birth of a child, any child, is a new incarnation and carries the promise of the great miracle of humans becoming divine or reaching out to the stars." I like that last line. Let's try it one more time. "The birth of any child is a new incarnation and carries the promise of the great miracle of humans becoming divine." These words echo very well those very well-known words by the Unitarian Universalist religious educator, mother of modern religious education, Sophia Faz, who said, "Each night a child is born is a holy night." We are each and all born with the power and the potential to touch lives in such a way that they will be transformed and uplifted. And we are each and all born with the power and the potential to touch our world in such a way that it will be a more just and humane place for our having been here. This is the promise. This is the wonder of incarnation. And how much of that promise, how much of that wonder will actually be fulfilled only depends upon how much of our humanity we're willing to risk sharing and we're willing to risk extending. The story of Jesus, from his birth to his death, which contains a mix that you can't really sort out all that well. It's a mix of myth, legend, and some history. However it's told, it's the story of someone who sought to fully live out and who sought to risk living out the divine potential with which we are each and all born. His story is the story of someone whose word, that is the same one whose promise or someone whose potential, became truly incarnated in the flesh. And how much of that story you choose to believe, on whatever level you believe it on, is not near as important as how much you believe in and how much you feel authentic with the story you were telling by the life you're leading. The important thing is how well your story incarnates the word by which you are seeking to live. So my hope for each of us in this season is that love and light and truth and wisdom and joy will become incarnate in the lives we live. I hope each of you finds some transformation in your lives. I hope we can all be bearers of hope and joy and renewal for one another and for others. And so as we hear the stories that are told at this time of year, may we find in them as well our own story and see it afresh. In the faces of children and in the beauty of the natural world, may we each and all find a renewed sense of life for ourselves. May our sense of priority in this season be that we will honor life, beginning with the lives we've been given, moving out to the life that surges all around us. Let's bear that in mind as we sing together our closing hymn, Psalm 228,